Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you tilt your Teflon-coated frying pan just so, water droplets will slide off the surface. But what if you could create a metal that was so abhorrent to water that water will do anything to stay away from it? In fact, picture a surface so capable of repelling water that the liquid just bounces clean off the surface. It's crazy to see this metal. And scientists at the University of Rochester have managed to make that metal do just that. And the key to creating such hydrophobic materials? Lasers. The results were published in the Journal of Applied Physics this week. How do the lasers transform the metal? How long does the water-resistant effect last? And what could real-world applications be? Joining me now to talk about this is Chun-Lei Guo, professor at the Institute of Optics at the University of Rochester in New York. He joins us today from WXXI. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Well, you're quite welcome. You know, I was looking at, we have the video on our website at sciencefriday.com. I was looking at this water just bounce off like crazy off this metal as if it doesn't, like it's too hot for it to be there.
Yeah, that certainly appears to be.
Yeah, but before, let's walk through the history of this. Because before you made the hydrophobic metal, a metal right. that hates the water, you had one that loved the water.
That's right, yeah. So really leading up this research is about a couple of years ago, we actually create a metal surface, also use the laser pulse, process the surface. We can create an extensive amount of surface structures at micro and nano scales. And this surface structure essentially turn a metal with so-called super hydrophilic. It loves water and attract water. And in fact, the super hydrophilic effect we created is so strong that, you know, if we I were able to do a demonstration here, so I can have a piece of metal, put a piece of metal stand vertically upward, and if we drop a drop of water at the bottom of the metal surface, the water will actually shoot up vertically against gravity.
Like a wick, you're sort of wicking up the water with the metal.
That's right.
And so now you've done just quite the opposite. You've made a metal surface using lasers that it repels the water so greatly that it doesn't even, they don't even have to tilt the metal for the water to literally bounce off the edge. How does the laser do that? What did you do to the surface? You didn't put a deposit any material on it, did you?
No. Yeah. So what happens is we use a very intense laser beam to process a metal surface. And so the laser we use is so-called femtosecond laser. A femtosecond, the length of the laser pulse, is actually a millionth of a billionth of a second. So the pulse is so short, actually the time it takes to blink your eyes will be astronomical compared to this pulse. But during this very short time burst, and the pulse actually will pack an extremely high power and intensity. So it's so high, and once we use the laser pulse to zap the metal, it's instantaneously just transform a smooth metal surface to create this extensive structures with nanoscale and microscale structures. Well, with these structures, it's really these structures alter the property of the metal. So in our latest finding, of course, we transform the metal and make it super hydrophobic or super water repellent.
Is it because the structures are the nanoparticles, the nanostructures that you make on the metal surface, like sort of etching the surface, is that because they're so small that the surface tension of the bubble can't get into those tiny little structures, so the bubble stays with its surface tension in the form of a droplet?
That certainly plays a role. Yes. So if you are looking at the interaction between the metal surface and the water molecules, you can think about there are two interactions going on here. One is the interaction between the metal surface and the water molecules, and the other is the interaction among the water molecules themselves. So essentially, so when we create these structures, one thing, like you said, we have these extensive nanostructures, microstructures. They can trap air, and the air will occupy the space and keep the water out. Mm. And in the other ways, we essentially reduce the surface area in contact with the water. And essentially, we simply just dramatically turn down the interaction between the metal surface and the water molecules. Incomparably, water molecules, they still have their attraction going on intact, and comparably will be much stronger, and therefore all these water molecules will glue up and beat up and bounce off the surface.
Now, what can you do with this? I imagine any time that you want a surface that does not hold the water and does not stay wet, this would be a good kind of surface you'd want to create. Something perhaps like an airplane wing that won't freeze up in the wintertime with ice on it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, if it can keep water away and will keep the ice away. And yeah, so we know the ice sometimes pose this real hazard, exactly like you said, on the airplane wings. And if we apply this technology on the wings and tails of an aircraft, we don't have to go through the de-icing anymore.
Yeah. What about, I know you're experimenting with sanitation. This seems to be a perfect solution to keeping something clean. Is it true that even bacteria, which are wet, right, they would slide right off of this?
That's right. Bacteria are wet. And just like our human body, we know our human body is made up mostly water. So are the bacteria, so are the pathogens, and so they have a lot of water. I don't think they will necessarily just slide right off, but when they sit there, and there's really nothing for them to flourish anymore, so they will die off soon.
Are other hydrophobic things, what do they do? Like oil, will oil bounce the same way, or is it just water?
So far we have been, we demonstrate this on water, and we have been looking at the oil as well. And we have some success with oil as well. And so that is one thing we have some success, we are continue working on. And hopefully we'll produce more success along that direction.
Let me ask you this question. When I saw the water bouncing off of this, I thought it was incredible. And I'm thinking, of course, replacing a Teflon pan with this material. But I'm also, as I'm watching the water bounce, I'm thinking, what happens if I want to fry an egg, and I drop the egg into the pan? Is it going to just keep bouncing up and down like that? Or I guess it will congeal on a hot surface at some point? Or you haven't thought about that yet?
Right. So it really depends. Water is 100% water, and they bounce off. And if you have an egg, and obviously they contain water, they contain some other things as well. So I think eventually they form an equilibrium, and because of gravity and whole things there. And I think the real thing benefit is if we were use our surface for a cooking pan, it will be much less sticky, and we can cook well and without any sticking.
Now, I understand that obviously you're in the developmental stage, and I understand from reading your paper that it takes a very long time to make one little square inch of this metal, right? It could take an hour, hours to do that. I guess you'll have to scale it up somehow. What's the breakthrough that you need to do that?
Yeah, that's right. So currently, the research just came out of the laboratory, and inside the lab, the laser we use is really geared towards laboratory exploration. And so it's not really, you know, we're not optimized the laser for industry applications. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, with the you know, more suitable laser source, with the more suitable, you know, processing procedures, and we are actually also working on scaling up and developing more optimized procedures. I think, you know, those combined will dramatically scale up the technology.
Have you got some industrial company interested yet? I'm sure you do. is this process patented?
Yes. Yes.
I would imagine.
Right.
And so where do you think we will see it showing up first?
You meant the application-wise?
Yeah, application-wise.
So far, one thing, early on you mentioned the sanitation application. Mm-hmm. And what we have been working on, we actually have been doing a project with the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, precisely for sanitation. And, you know, you mentioned pathogens and bacteria, so are waste material, human waste. And so in that project, we are looking at, you know, if we can make the water, make this surface repel waste and reduce, enhance the waste management without relying on using a lot of water to flush. So there, we're also looking at actually applying the technology to other materials as well, and maybe combining some other techniques, so make this more suitable and scalable for applications.
Well, Dr. Guo, we wish you a lot of luck. Good luck. It sounds like an interesting and exciting project. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Chun-Lei Guo is professor at the Institute of Optics at the University of Rochester in New York, and he was joining us from WXXI today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, talk to a black hole pioneer remembering his historic collaboration with the young Stephen Hawking, Roger Penrose. Yes, the Roger Penrose will join us after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 45 years ago, next Tuesday, a paper appeared in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society, and it was a paper of cosmic importance. It was the product of an historic collaboration, the mathematician Roger Penrose working with a newly minted PhD named Stephen Hawking, and it would help bring black holes into the physics mainstream. Remember that in 1970, black holes were exotic stuff. Many physicists thought they didn't actually exist, and that so-called space-time singularities were a mathematical fluke. So it was big news when Penrose and Hawking published results showing just the opposite. Not only did black holes exist, but the universe began with a space-time singularity, the Big Bang. Perhaps if you saw the latest biopic, Stephen Hawking biopic, The Theory of Everything, you saw a little bit of the collaboration between Hawking and Penrose. Maybe you want to talk about it. Our number is 1-844-724-8255, 844-PSI-TALK. And today we're going to be talking about this moment when black holes went mainstream with Dr. Penrose. He's an emeritus professor of math at the Oxford University. He joins us now from Oxford in the UK. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Penrose.
Hello.
You have an interesting way of explaining what you and Dr. Hawking were doing. You call it the hairy dog theorem. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yes. Well, the idea was that the thing we were trying to do was to show that these singularities, first of all in the black hole and secondly in the Big Bang, which people knew about already, but only in very, very special circumstances, when the situation was exactly symmetrical and the material involved didn't have any pressure and so on. It's very, very special. And people didn't necessarily believe that those singularities would be general things which could occur under completely general circumstances. So the thing was that in those days, that was before sort of 1964 or so, people used to either solve equations with, you know, complicated equations, or they'd use computers or something like that, but you couldn't really cope with the complicated general situation. So I started to think about these things in terms of what you call topological argument. That means you don't solve equations, you use argument, quite general arguments, to show that, in this case, a singularity had to exist somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now, the example of the hairy dog, it's quite a well-known topological theorem. Just gives you an idea of the kind of thing that it's about. You imagine a dog. Well, a dog, for this purpose, is basically a sphere, but you can imagine it's got legs pushed out and a tail pushed out and a head. But it's basically a sphere, as far as you could continuously deform that into a dog surface into a sphere. And you imagine that every point on that dog, there is hair growing. Even its nose, you see, right the way, all the way around. Now, the theorem tells you that if that hair is sort of flat, you put it, comb it down flat, there must be somewhere where the hair doesn't comb down flat. There's a singularity somewhere, a little whirl or something like that, where the hair doesn't go down flat. And that's a singularity in the direction of the hair. Now, this theorem doesn't depend on any details of the shape of the dog at all. It just depends on the fact that it's topologically a sphere. You could sort of distort the dog's surface into a sphere without tearing it or something.
So it doesn't tell you where that little cowlick is.
Exactly.
But it's there somewhere.
It's there somewhere,
and,
yeah.
And you'd already been investigating what happens when a star collapses.
Yes. Well, I was thinking about the situation that we now call a black hole. In those days, they didn't even have a word for it, but where the matter collapses down past a point of no return. Well, this point of no return was a thing I called a trapped surface, that it doesn't depend on any symmetry or anything like that. It's just a point of no return that you can characterize. And when it gets to that level, you can use these sort of topological arguments to show that somewhere in the future of that collapse, there must be a singularity.
And Stephen Hawking took your reasoning and expanded it a little bit further?
Well, you see, my argument was basically local. It had to do with an object, when I say basically local, reasonably local, a thing like a star it could be a supermassive object, but it didn't extend to the whole universe. And I didn't even think, well, I thought about the whole universe case, but I wasn't trying to do that. But Stephen, the first thing he did was to show that this condition of a trapped surface, which is a point of no return thing, in the case of the whole universe, you could find one if you went to absolutely enormous scales. So you don't think of the reasonably localized objects as a black hole, a star or something like that. You think of it as applying to the entire universe, and also in the direction of time going in the opposite. So it's expanding rather than collapsing. But that's a fairly obvious point. The point that was not obvious was that you could apply this condition on the cosmological scale. And then using that, you could show that the universe as a whole must be a sort of time-reverse black hole in the sense, and there would be a singularity there. Then he generalized these arguments. See, the original argument applied only when you didn't have a spatially closed universe. It went on to infinity. So the idea was to try and extend these to other types of universe models. And Stephen developed the arguments in all sorts of ways to apply them to cosmology and circumstances like that.
I want to bring a little bit of a clip from the movie where the movie explains what you and Hawking were up to, and this is the actor Eddie Redmayne playing Stephen Hawking talking to his then-girlfriend, Jane Wilde.
If Einstein is right, or if general relativity is correct, then the universe is expanding, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so if you reverse time, then the universe is getting smaller.
All right.
So what if I reverse the process all the way back to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
The beginning of time itself.
Yes. So the universe getting smaller and smaller, getting denser and denser, hotter and hotter.
You mean wind back the clock?
Yeah, exactly, wind back the clock.
That's a scene from The Theory of Everything. What do you think about that? You're laughing.
Yes.
Why are you laughing?
Well, it's all... it's very nicely done. I enjoyed the movie. I mean, I didn't think you got much science out of it, but I enjoyed the movie just as it was a nice story. But if you want to get the science out of it, I don't think you get much out of that. The thing is that I think the point that isn't brought out at all is the fact that, I mean, there were known solutions even a long time ago in the early 1920s, very soon after Einstein produced his general theory of relativity. The Russian mathematician Alexander Friedman had solved the equations to show there was a singularity at the Big Bang, you see. So that was already long known. But the thing was, it seemed to be a very, very special situation. You had symmetry assumed, the material had no pressure, it was what we call dust. It was a very, very special situation. And people didn't necessarily believe that that very special situation would apply when you have an irregular universe. And so, the movie didn't really bring out what we were doing, in a sense.
Well, one of the great breakthrough was in discovering possible black holes, which people didn't think exist. They thought it was just some mathematical construct, right?
Well, I think that's the same thing, yes. Yeah. I mean, because it's only in these very symmetrical cases, which you couldn't really trust.
Right, it's just and a mathematical model.
What we were able to show was those very special cases did, in fact, fairly well represent the general case. That although there are a lot of detail differences, the general situation would be more or less like that, so that the collapse to a black hole, which was again known, Oppenheimer and Snyder showed it just before the Second World War, 1939, they had a paper showing it collapsed to a black hole, what we now call a black hole. But again, it was this very, very symmetrical situation which people didn't trust. So we had to use these general arguments, like what you show with the hairy dog, that these singularities are completely general. They occur no matter how irregular the collapse is or the expansion is in the case of the universe.
So what does it matter to me as an average citizen if there are singularities out there in the universe?
Well, it's not so much the singularities because you can't get at them, you see. At least the ones in the black holes, it's more that the black hole is a stable thing. It doesn't collapse down and then swish out again. You could imagine that if the matter collapsed in an irregular way, it might swirl around in some complicated way and then come swishing out again. But what these arguments show is that doesn't happen. It collapses and keeps on collapsing in the same way that the symmetrical situation did, and it becomes singular. Now, the singularity is not accessible to us in the black hole. The Big Bang's another question because, of course, that singularity is, in a sense, the origin of all the things we know about.
Black holes, and then all of a sudden, after your papers are published, a few books were written, black holes really caught people's imaginations. Were you surprised by the amount of public interest in your work?
It took quite a long time. I was surprised. Well, there wasn't a great deal of interest to begin with. I mean, I used to go to these meetings, the Texas meetings on relativistic astrophysics. I was there at the first one. That was when people were just beginning to realize that you had situations which might be something like a black hole. And it took a long time. I remember going to several of these meetings every 2 years or so. And each time there was a bit more interest and a bit more interest. And it took quite a while before people really swung around and the general community believed that these objects were really likely to be there.
Why do you think there is? Why are people so fascinated by this idea?
Well, they're pretty wild things, aren't they? Yeah. And they're also, now we know they're absolutely huge ones. There are, 10,000 million times the mass of the sun. There's some absolutely whopping ones. Our galaxy has one which is about 4 million times as massive as the sun. But there are now known ones which are far, far bigger than that.
I know you're working on some new theories. Are you changing the views about the Big Bang, the start of the universe, things like that over the years?
Well, yeah. I did change my mind about something rather important there about 8 years ago or so.
What was that?
Well, the question is whether the Big Bang really was the beginning. Now, you see, what Stephen and I were showing was that if you take the general theory of relativity, Einstein's general relativity, and you extend it backwards as far as you go, you get to this singular state. Now, the thing is, it's not just any old singular state. It's a very, very special one. It has to be very, very special because there's this thing called the second law of thermodynamics, which tells us that as time goes forward in a normal way, things get more and more random. So that another way of saying that is if you go backwards, then things get less and less random. So the Big Bang must have been an extremely special situation. So that despite the theorems that we were showing, Stephen in particular for the Big Bang, that you, even in very general circumstances you get a singularity, the fact is that this Big Bang was something very, very special. And in fact, it's such a special thing that you can stretch it out without affecting the physics. Now, it's a kind of subtle point, because it depends on the physics at the very early stages of the universe being... The universe was so enormously hot.
So when you say stretch it out, you don't mean it's that infinitesimal little tiny time when the explosion had? The time is longer?
I mean, it's an interesting question. It depends how you measure time, you see. If you measure time according to the way people do it now, with very, very precise clocks and things, these depend on mass. They always depend on having mass. If you didn't have any mass, you wouldn't have a measure of time. Mm-hmm. Now, you see, when you get very close to the Big Bang, things get so hot that the mass of particles becomes irrelevant. And so, in effect, you don't have any mass there. So that the notion of time that we employ now ceases to become relevant. And this means that you can adopt a picture where the Big Bang was stretched out, and it wasn't really a point at all. Hmm. It's a kind of complicated... I need a whole new program to explain that.
Okay, we'll come back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. Talking with Dr. Roger Penrose about his new theories of what could have happened, I guess, at the Big Bang. So I have a few minutes left. What does this discovery of dark energy do to all the theories about the universe?
Dark energy is, well, it's, in my view, I would prefer to call it the cosmological constant,
okay,
because it was introduced by Einstein a little bit as an afterthought. But it was very clear. You see, the original theory he produced in 1915, and in 1917 he produced he added another term, which was the cosmological constant.
Eventually, calling it the biggest mistake he ever made.
He called it the biggest mistake. But what's rather ironic about that is it actually turned out to be true.
But does that affect anybody's theories and
yes,
your thinking about that?
Absolutely crucial. Yeah.
How?
You see, well, the main way it's affected things now is that you have a universe which is accelerating in its expansion. This is observed. In fact, that's why we think there was a cosmological constant, or dark energy, or whatever you call it, that the universe is expanding in this accelerated way. But the thing is that means, it makes a crucial difference to this scheme of mine, because it means that the future infinity looks like a Big Bang. Now, it's hard for me to explain that, certainly not in the half a second I've got left, or whatever it is. But it means that the structure of the remote future is very much like a scaled-up version of a Big Bang. And so what I'm saying is that our Big Bang had, prior to it, the remote future of another, well, I'm calling it an eon. The eon, our eon, started with a Big Bang and will end with this exponentially expanding universe. That's what we seem to see. Now, that exponential expansion occurred prior to the Big Bang and looked like, scaled down, looked like the stretched out Big Bang. So you have to have a physics which doesn't pay attention to scaling down and stretching out. And that means that you can sort of go through the Big Bang into this previous eon.
So you have eon Big Bang. So the universe is sort of repeating itself.
Yes.
Over and over again.
Yes, but not precisely. I mean, it'll be a little bit different each time, but it's generally the same.
Do you believe in the multiverse, that there are other?
Well, this is a different kind of multiverse. I don't believe in these parallel. See, usually people, when say multiverse, they mean these sort of parallel universes. This is a sequential sequence of universe models, if you like.
So that there's not parallel ones, there just has been one universe.
One after the other. That's right. Yeah, I call it one universe, yes. Mm. That's why I use the word eon, because it's all one universe, and what goes on in the previous one feeds into ours, and what will go on into ours feeds into the next one. Mm. And information can get through, so it's not completely disjoint.
Are you surprised that people are interested in these things?
Well, I'm surprised people aren't more interested. I think they think it's crazy, you see. I find it very difficult. I mean, I think there's good evidence. It's not just that this is just an idea. I and a colleague and some Polish people have done observational analysis of the cosmic microwave background, and they have found that there are signals of the kind that you do expect in this model.
Wow. Well, Dr. Penrose, we'll have you back to talk more about it, because we could take a lot more time.
It'll take more time, yes.
Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
And happy 45th anniversary.
Oh, thanks very much.
Roger Penrose, Emeritus Professor of Math, or the Maths, I guess they would say, at Oxford University in the UK. We're going to take a break. When we come back, break out your rucksack, get your pith helmet on, because we're going to, in search of Cuban coral reefs and the, well, maybe the supposed scalp, the alleged scalp of a Yeti. Who knows? We'll come back. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. Hey, podcast listeners, take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Many years ago, I got my first scuba diving experience in the vast Elkhorn coral reefs of the Caribbean. Today, those corals are all but gone, dead. Coral reefs are dying at an alarming rate, except for one place, Cuba. Coral reefs in the Caribbean seem to be hit particularly hard. Since 1970, about half of the coral cover in the region has disappeared. And while rising ocean temperatures and pollution runoffs are bleaching and killing corals all over the world, corals in some parts of Cuba are not only surviving, but they are thriving. Why is that? My next guest is here to give us a little insight on why this might be. David Guggenheim is a marine scientist and president of Ocean Doctor, a conservation organization based in Washington, and he's been working on conservation efforts in Cuba for the past 15 years. He joins us in our CUNY studio here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much, Ira.
Why Florida, where the reefs are dying, and Cuba, they're 90 miles apart. Why such a big difference?
Well, if you think about how Cuba has developed, it's just developed so differently than the rest of the Caribbean and certainly from Florida over those last 50 years where we've seen so much of the destruction of the oceans taking place. And we know that Cuba has developed in a way that has resulted in fewer nutrient pollution episodes going on in their waters. Nutrients in the water do the same thing that they do on land. They fuel the growth of plants and algae, and those algae overgrow the coral reefs. After the Soviets pulled out, Cuba couldn't afford fertilizers or pesticides, so they were kind of forced into organic farming, and that's had a beneficial effect on corals.
Is there one part of Cuba where the corals are in better shape than other parts?
I think the crown jewel is Gardens of the Queen. That's on the south coast around the center of the country, about 50 miles offshore. And I first started scuba diving when I was a teenager in the Florida Keys, loved it, saw that Elkhorn coral that you mentioned. It was just enthralling. And over the years have had to endure, like many of us, the disappearance of those corals. So when I went back to this place, it looked better than I remembered as a teenager in the early 70s. It looked incredibly pristine. And not only was there that Elkhorn coral that is 95% extinct from the Caribbean now, where we were diving, but I was told it was part of a barrier reef system that I later found out extended for 30 miles.
Wow. And it's still in, it's probably the most pristine place in this hemisphere?
It's certainly the most pristine that I've ever seen and in the Caribbean. And for the first time in recent years, gave me hope about the future of coral reefs. That if we can learn from this living laboratory how a healthy coral reef is supposed to look and function, then those are very valuable insights we can use for restoration efforts around the Caribbean.
This freezing of relations with Cuba, is that going to help the science there, or scientists there, and you in particular do research on the corals?
We've had quite a challenge over the last 15 years working in Cuba. The Cuban scientists are fantastic. They're very well educated and dedicated, but they've got very few resources. The University of Havana's Center for Marine Research, our primary partner, they have two vessels. One has been at the bottom of a river for more than 15 years. The other one is literally made out of rock. It's a ferro cement hull, And it's not a great vessel, really. So a lot of what we've done is bring in equipment, try to charter boats and other things to let the Cubans do what they do so well, which is great science, and get these students out on the water to do science. But under the restrictions, that's been enormously difficult. Bringing in equipment, Cuba still is on the list of the State Department's list of terrorist nations, which restricts all sorts of equipment like electronics.
Mm-hmm. Do you fear that maybe tourists now who may be flocking to Cuba, and there go the reefs are the Cubans aware of that? Going to keep the tourists away?
Well, you know, the other reason that Cuba's coral reefs are so healthy is that they have fantastic environmental laws in place. They have protected 25% of their waters in marine protected areas. That's compared to the worldwide average of about 1%. So they are very good stewards of their environment, and I have faith in them to continue that. But we've all seen the track record of the United States. We tend to mess things up that we love. And I think there are a lot of people with their eyes on Cuba. So one of our projects is actually working with the Cubans on developing good decision tools for the future. And that includes environmental economics, helping the Cubans put a price on their natural ecosystems. What is the value that these ecosystems provide? And look at alternatives like sustainable ecotourism. And so far, that's been going very well.
Now, we've heard about all these lionfish in Florida and all around this, you know, the coast of the southern coast of the U.S. Are they invading Cuba also?
They have invaded
They're
Cuba.
There. They have landed.
Sadly, they are everywhere. And they are now moving down the South American coast. It's a pretty frightening time series if you look at the time series of how fast this population is exploding. The problem is these guys are incredibly voracious predators. They don't belong there. They're from the Indo-Pacific. And these little reef fish that grow up to be big, important reef fish are the primary target of these lionfish.
Are the Cubans, do they have any ideas about how to combat this?
Well, what we've been doing with Cuban scientists at Gardens of the Queen, which is a healthy ecosystem, meaning it has lots of sharks and groupers and other predators, is they are experimenting with enticing these sharks and groupers with lionfish. So they'll go out and spear them and offer them up to the sharks. And
hopefully they develop a taste
for
the lionfish.
Exactly. And it looks like it's a little bit spicy because they do have those venomous spines, but they seem to get them down okay. There don't seem to be long-term effects. The fishermen are finding them in the guts of grouper, and the dive masters down there are seeing sharks take them even without diver intervention now, which is exciting. And it really makes you think about a basic principle of ecology, that a healthy ecosystem is difficult to invade. All of the niches are filled. The question is, who's going to be the first one to eat the new thing that appears? And that's an interesting question of evolution and animal behavior.
Mm-hmm. What's the biggest challenge to the reefs now? When you go down to study them, what are you studying?
Well, we're studying, I think the biggest challenge is keeping the reefs healthy as we move forward.
Does that mean keeping overfishing down to a minimum?
That's a big part of it is making sure that these protected areas can remain protected. And that means, in some cases, helping the local communities, these Cuban communities that depend on fishing, find alternatives. And in the case of Gardens of the Queen, most of the former fishermen are now employees of the park, working out there guiding catch-and-release fishing or scuba diving trips and making maybe 10 times what they used to make. It's helping.
Good luck to you, Vaughn.
Thank you very much.
And hope to get down there and see it sometime myself.
Anytime. You're invited.
Yeah, David Guggenheim is a marine scientist and president of Ocean Doctor, a conservation organization based out of Washington, D.C. Hope you're joining us for our Science Friday book club. We've picked David Grand's Lost City of Z. And if you've been reading along, you've been following Percy Fawcett into the deep jungle of the Amazon, fighting off skin-burrowing insects, malaria, snakes, and running into the occasional native folk. There's a chance for you to experience these Golden Age expeditions firsthand if you're in New York. If you live in New York, you're coming to New York. The Explorers Club is home to collections of artifacts from a flag from the Apollo 11 mission to alleged a Yeti scalp they claim is there. And Emily Driscoll is a video producer. She went on a private tour of the collection. You can watch a video of her behind-the-scenes tour at her website at sciencefriday.com. She joins us in our CUNY studios. Welcome back, Emily.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Let's talk about your video. What does it look like when you walk into the Explorers Club?
When you walk into the Explorers Club, you feel like you're walking into a different era completely. I mean, it's collection of 100 years worth of artifacts that explorers have collected on their various expeditions, whether they be the bottom of the ocean or Mount Everest or in space even. It's really remarkable. You see tusks, all kinds of tusks. There are mammoth tusks, even narwhal tusks. And they
are they sensitive to the fact that they have all these stuffed animals and tusks?
Well, these are definitely from a different era. A lot of them were specimens, and some of them originally were meant for the Museum of Natural History, and some of them were at the Museum of Natural History and are now at the Explorers Club. So, like a cheetah, an adolescent polar bear, and they were very much brought there for science, and they don't take new taxidermy.
Mm. And supposedly there's a Yeti scalp there.
Yes, brought by Sir Edmund Hillary
to
test whether it was a Yeti scalp, and they found that it actually, some other scientists from different countries found that it was a goat-like antelope scalp, a couple of different things.
Oh, shucks. Why was the Explorers Club founded in the first place?
It was founded around 1904 when explorers wanted to get together, talk about their expeditions, and also support future expeditions. And also there was an Arctic Club around the same time where polar explorers would talk about all of their going to the South Pole, North Pole, and they joined together to become the Explorers Club.
Because, and they also talk about, and you know, explorers of the quote-unquote exploration age, which is, you know, about 100 years ago, about at this period, 100 years ago, especially Shackleton or Robert Falcon Scott, who went to the South Pole, they say that science was always part of their mission, right?
Yes.
They were collecting samples for this or that.
Exactly. And everything that went involved with the technology to go to the moon. Former members, like you said, have been Amundsen, Shackleton, Robert Perry and Matthew Henson, who went to the North Pole, Sir Edmund Hillary, Tenzing Norgay, who summited Everest, also Don Walsh, who went to the Mariana Trench in 1960 with Jacques Picard. And a lot of that was also not just to go to the trench and study that, but the technology involved in making the submersibles.
Mm-hmm. So they were doing science along the way.
Exactly. And yeah. James Cameron, actually, he just went to the Mariana Trench as well, and his Deep Sea Challenger was called a vertical torpedo because it had a unique vertical design, and that was the science involved with that.
Talking with Emily Driscoll, video producer of Bonsai Films here in New York, about our video pick of the week. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the Explorers Club. It's our new video at sciencefriday.com. This is I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Did any one thing, when you walked in, take your breath away, you looked at it? The video is terrific up there on our website.
Thanks.
Anything you say, whoa.
So many things, just because, and also there are things just in plain sight that you wouldn't even know were part of an exploration. Like the coffee table that they have there is actually a hatch from the USS Explorer, which was one of the seven ships that survived the Pearl Harbor attack.
Mm-hmm. And they still have expeditions underway now.
Oh,
right?
Of course.
There's always something going on that they have helped fund or support.
Yes, and like you said, they give away $250,000 per year for expeditions to students and also scientists. But, you know, only 5% of the ocean has been explored. And the space, we have so much more, and we're going to Mars, and that's the plan. But Edie Witter, for example, she and her team captured the giant squid on camera for the first time, and she developed technology for her submersible that was quiet and that had light that wouldn't disturb the animals. So that's how she was able to do that.
Mm.
And Jeff Bezos, he recovered the Apollo 11 F1 engine.
Oh, he did. That's right.
He was honored at the Explorers Club dinner this year.
Now, you are, we need something secret here. You're a member, right?
Yes.
And they have an annual dinner that's kind of wild.
It's coming up in March. Yep.
What's it like?
It's just indescribable. I mean, I got there 10 minutes late to the hors d'oeuvres, and the Madagascar hissing cockroaches were already gone.
Oh, no.
And speaking of Jeff Bezos, he did eat one of them.
You got there.
Yeah. But they serve invasive species. They serve. It started as sharing different cultures. Will Roseman, the executive director at the Explorers Club, he was a bush pilot in the Congo. And he said that if they didn't eat grubs, then they wouldn't survive. So that's how it started, sharing that. But also, it's just to recognize amazing explorations and explorers that are going on around the globe.
Well, it's our video pick of the week up on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's behind the scenes look at the Explorers Club. Emily Driscoll, our video producer, who did the video for us. She's a novelist and a Sci-Fi Book Club member. And she's also going to be going to that dinner at the Explorers Club. Thank you for taking time to be with us. Great video.
Thank you.
It's a great video. And if you're in New York, I want to remind you, if you're in New York and you want an in-person peek inside the Explorers Club, you're about to get your chance next Tuesday. Next Tuesday, put that on your list. Our Science Friday Book Club meets in person at the Explorers Club to talk about our new book, David Grand's The Lost City of Z. David's going to be joining us in person. I'm going to chat with him right there at the club about Z, about its eccentric hero, explorer Percy Fawcett. It all happens this Tuesday, January 27th, so New Yorkers, don't wait. If you want a ticket, go to sciencefriday.com/bookclub to reserve your spot. And novelist and sci-fi book club member Jeff Vandermeer has already started reading. We've asked him for his feelings about Fawcett so far.
Well, I love the glorious contradictions of his character. He's on this most quixotic of quests, and yet he's also pragmatic. He names this base camp Dead Horse Camp because literally his horse died there. And he believes the city of Z exists, but he kind of needs it to exist, because if it doesn't exist, then all he's really doing is tromping around in the jungle, which I think is really kind of what he wanted to do anyway.
So is Fawcett a quixotic dreamer or a genius no one understands? Tell us using the hashtag Sci-Fi Book Club, Sci-Fi Book Club. And we hope to see you next Tuesday at the Explorers Club. If you want a ticket, they're going fast. Go to sciencefriday.com/bookclub. to reserve your spot. That's all the time we have for today. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Ruskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the dials here at our studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you want to hear it again, point your device over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We invite you to join our mailing list. And if you like us, follow us all week on Facebook. Like us there. And we continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. And you can download our iPhone and Android apps, listen and watch the videos on demand anywhere you are. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.